I am Planta on the line here at the commentary.ca. Stevie Cameron joins me from here in Vancouver today to discuss her new book, The Picton File. You can't not encounter the Picton case when reading newspapers in this part of the country, and I suspect elsewhere. Here are some numbers. 65 is the number of women on the police's official missing women's list. 26 is the number of women Picton is charged with killing. 600,000 is the number of exhibits seized by police. 200,000 is the number of DNA samples processed by the RCMP crime labs. There are 7 on the prosecution's team, 10 on the defense. The one person on trial is Robert William Willie Picton. If he is convicted, he will have the horrific distinction of being the worst serial killer in Canadian history. Retailing for $24.95, the book, which is published by Knopf, looks at the run-up to the trial, the accused himself, the women who went missing from the city's downtown east side, and how Cameron has covered this case here and beyond. It is a serviceable précis of this exhaustive and sometimes exhausting and exasperating case. Cameron has done a remarkable job getting into this case, and reading what she's done thus far is interesting and important. Stevie Cameron is the author of 4 best-selling books, a graduate of UBC and a Cordon Bleu trained cook, who heads up a program where food, clothing, and medical services are provided to some of Toronto's homeless. I am pleased to welcome to the Planta on the Line program Stevie Cameron. Good morning, Ms. Cameron.
Morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. This is not the book that you'd intended to write. Why this book and why now?
Well, no, it isn't. I never intended to write a book like this. But my publisher asked me if I would, and that's because we don't know when the other book can be published. You know, there are still publication bans covering the material in the other book. There are still issues around the current trial. There's a lot of stuff that can't be reported. We don't know when the second trial on another 20 counts of first-degree murder will happen. We don't even know if it will happen. So we foresee publication of The Pig Farm, the book I've been working on all these years, as maybe being 2 to 3 years away. So she said to me, would you be willing to write a book about a personal story? I want you to write it in the first person. I want you to tell people what it's been like to work on this for 5 years, and I'd like you, if you can, do a kind of guide to this story. So give people an overview of it, let them know what you think you can tell about it. And so that's what I've been doing on this one.
And has it been a rewarding experience for you? I know that it's come at some personal cost financially, but you've gotten to know a lot of the families, correct?
You know, it's been a terrific experience. The whole thing. I've enjoyed working on this first book, The Picton File. I've loved working on the second book, the one that will come out eventually, I think, you know, God willing. And, you know, I think it's been the most rewarding experience I've ever had as a journalist. And you know, besides that, it allows me to live in Vancouver, which is my favorite city, and anywhere in the world to live.
This publication ban that's covering this trial, I guess I can't ask you about specifics, but what sort of material, what sort of stuff isn't in this book that you'd have liked to put in?
Well, Joe, we've got 2 trials happening. The first one right now is on 6 counts of first-degree murder. But there's another trial that's scheduled to happen when this one ends, and it's on 20 counts of first-degree murder, and there is no evidence on the 20 that can be published at this point. And you know, just think about what this trial's involved. Imagine another one on 20 counts. And so I attended the preliminary hearing in 2003. It was 7 months long. I also attended almost all of the voir dire in 2005, 2006, and that lasted more than a year. In fact, it lasted right into 2007. And so I've listened to hundreds of witnesses, including all the witnesses that have appeared at the trial this year. And much of that evidence that I've heard cannot be reported yet, because we're only looking at the first 6. So just imagine that. There's a massive amount of information that is still under publication bans. And then there was another problem, not just the bans that affect all of us, but the fact that I can't report anything in this new book that could influence the jury in the trial We have an ongoing criminal trial underway right now. It has a 12-person jury, and I'm not going to publish anything that might influence them because of the horrendous legal consequences. The judge could declare a mistrial, and you know, that would be setting everybody back to square one again if they felt the jury was influenced. So you see the restrictions that I was under to publish this particular book. And my publisher understood all that when she asked me to do it. She said, I want a personal story. I want you to tell me what your life has been like, as well as telling us what this, as much as you can about the case.
We've heard in recent weeks, in lay people that follow the trial, I guess, through the newspapers, through the news on television, this testimony from this fellow named Casanova, as well as last week, this person that... who worked for, I guess...
Scott Chubb?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, what's the difference there? Why do we hear about that sort of stuff, but we can't hear about this other stuff that you obviously know about, people that cover the trial know about?
Because there was no jury present when we listened to testimony during the preliminary hearing and during the voir dire.
So this stuff is
And even now, there are times when the... judge will ask the jury to leave the room, and the lawyers will get into some kind of a wrangle or a discussion with the judge, and only with the permission of the judge can that material be reported. Most of it is not reported.
Do you think, though, in terms of what's being reported, that the public has gotten tired of the Picton case, and your reaction to that?
I don't think the public is being offered very much on the Picton case. There's an enormous amount of material that can be reported. And there's fascinating testimony and fascinating stuff coming out of the court every day. Laurie Culbert at the Vancouver Sun is doing a wonderful job covering the trial on a daily basis. But almost from the beginning, the Sun has buried the stories in the second section, the local section. And so if you're interested, you can find it. But they're certainly not putting it on page one.
Is that because people are sensitive? Do you think that it's not tasteful or that it's too gruesome for some readers?
Well, that's the reason for it, but they didn't do that with Bernardo, and I felt that the story with the Paul Bernardo murder case in Ontario was worse. In many ways, it was, you know, I think it was harder on reporters to cover, and I think it was also very hard on the readers, because in that particular case, the evidence included tape recordings of the women, of these young teenage girls being tortured. And we have nothing like that in this case. I mean, murder cases are never pretty. They're stories of war, stories of gruesome murders are never pretty. I think that this is an important story. And I think it's being underreported, but, you know, that's me. I think the Globe and Mail is covering it, Canadian Press is covering it faithfully, day by day. So is Laurie Culbert at The Sun. But by and large, most media outlets have just ignored it.
One of the interesting things about reading this book and is getting to know some of the family, and through them, some of the women that have gone missing. The one thing that I noticed you sort of talked about throughout the book is that there were some failures on the part of the law enforcement in terms of listening to their complaints, listening to their reports, following up on their reports of missing women. That's something that comes up, I guess, a great deal, that nobody cared about the people in the downtown east side.
Nobody cared about them except the people who loved them. You know, I mean, their families cared about them. I mean, these women may not have had lives that you and I would want to have, but they had lives. And they had people they loved, and they had people who loved them. And these included their children, and their mothers, and their sisters, and fathers, and brothers. You know, it's their friends cared about them. And they did have lives. They did, you know, engage with a big community in a way that you and I might not like, but that was their life. And but there was a kind of judgment that those lives were not important, and in fact were reprehensible. And so they were not people that the police in Vancouver really particularly cared about and or thought needed to be followed up on. They were the disposable people. And it's not fair to label all of the Vancouver police with that, because there are many police officers who worked very hard to find these women and who cared about them, but unfortunately, the senior management and certainly the missing persons unit didn't care and didn't do anything about it.
Do you foresee later on some sort of investigation, as we see now in the Air India inquiry?
I think that there will be, at least two. One's been done, Joe. One has been completed by Deputy Chief Constable Doug Lepard. He instigated a two-year, he supervised a two-year investigation about what went wrong within the Vancouver Police. And part of his investigation was released to the Vancouver Sun in a story that Chad Skelton wrote a few years ago about the Vancouver Police Missing Persons Unit being a disaster. And it has been repaired, and they now have a very effective Missing Persons Unit. But in the days that these women went missing, it was worse than useless. It was desperately lacking in leadership, and they did nothing, and they lied to families, and they didn't file reports, and the whole horrible story is in the Sun and in my book. But that's only part of the Lepard report. His report is also looking at the failure of the police to recognize this is a serious issue. That there might be a serial killer looking, in their community. That there might be, these women might have been killed. And there's been a lot of finger pointing about this in the last few years. And I think his report is pretty comprehensive. The big issue is if we'll ever see it. We don't know if that will ever be made public. So if it is, that would be the first big examination. The second one will be a judicial inquiry, we expect. Most of us expect there will be a judicial inquiry, but that could be some years away. And I'm sure there are a lot of people in Vancouver who hope it'll never happen.
One of the other things that I noticed that you've immersed yourself in the story by getting to know these people, the families of the victims. Did you still hang out in the downtown east side? Did you walk the streets there still?
Oh, yes.
How do you find, we talked about them being underserved in the past. Do you find that there has been a change today?
No. There's nothing changed in the downtown east side.
Are women still going missing?
No, women are not still going missing. That is the one thing that has changed. But in terms of their personal circumstances, in terms of being able to get into detox and into a rehab that isn't going to send them back on the route of drugs and prostitution again, no, nothing's changed. They in terms of their living in squalor and in overcrowded, terrible conditions with hotels that are run by drug dealers, nothing has changed. But I think that if a woman goes missing on the downtown east side, the Missing Persons Unit and the Vancouver Police work very hard to find her.
Trying to understand someone like Robert Picton is hard. What's your read on him? I guess you haven't been able to talk to him, but you've talked to people that know him.
I've talked to a lot of people that have known him for a long time. I've been able to look at his life from childhood on and talk to many people who knew him for a long time and were very close to him. And this is a guy who was not, as many people think, a loner. He was not stupid. He liked company. He liked to have a good time. He enjoyed reading tabloid newspapers. He liked going to the supermarket. He even, with one woman I know, used to love doing that. And he once provided the food for a friend's shower, this infamous Gina Houston, who testified not long ago. He offered to provide all the food for a baby shower a friend was having for her. He liked to help. He'd be the first person to be there for you with a loan of money or some, equipment if you needed it. I mean, he's a very odd figure, but not a quiet, surly loner as many people think he is.
And unsavvy, I guess, is the other thing that the defense is trying to paint him as.
No, I would. My reading of him is not at all unsavvy. My reading of him is very cunning, smart. Not intellectual, but a street smart guy, very street smart. And he's been surrounded by that kind of community all his life, people who were pretty, worked hard and knew how to do the best for themselves. He was a hard worker, and but I would say pretty cunning.
Someone that that is mentioned in the book not too infrequently is Dave Picton. He's the brother of Willie Picton. What's his role in this? He hasn't been charged with anything, or has he?
No, he does have a criminal conviction in his background. He was convicted of assaulting a woman that worked for him in his business. And, you know, he's a very controversial figure. It's interesting. The question I get asked the most, the two questions that I get asked all the time and have been for 5 years, and the first question is always, what about the brother? Everybody thinks that there is no way that Dave Picton could not have known about his brother, and if William Picton indeed was murdering these women, and they also feel that he might have participated. That's certainly been the defense strategy, is to try to throw some of the of this on the brother. But the second question I get asked is, of course, what's it like to work on this? And so I've tried to talk about the brother in this book, and I've tried to talk about what it's been like to work on this.
Why aren't there? Has he been investigated? Has he been a suspect at any point? And when? What about charging other people?
I think the police have said in this trial, testified that he was a suspect, and that they did consider. They certainly did consider him one. And there was a bit of confusion during the trial. And I think ultimately there was a statement made that he is no longer a suspect. And yes, the defense has also in recent weeks been suggesting that other people might have been involved. I think they suggested Pat Casanova, a butcher who was a friend of Mr. Picton, of Willie Picton's, might have been involved, and also Dinah Taylor, another friend of Mr. Picton's. You know, there have been a number of names thrown around.
Around the same time that women started disappearing in the downtown east side, the Green River Killer in Washington State, not far from Vancouver, that was going on. Is there any connection, do you think, to the women missing in the downtown east side and the Green River Killer?
I don't know that anyone has ever proved a connection. I certainly know that there is a belief in the downtown east side that there was a connection, because one of the missing women, one of the women that Mr. Picton has been charged with murdering, is was said to have partied with the Green River Killer. His name was Gary Ridgway, and this woman was Heather Chinook, and her boyfriend has told reporters that she used to talk about going to parties with Gary Leon Ridgway, the Green River Killer. I have spoken to two women who believe that they were attacked by the Green River Killer, by Gary Ridgway, when he was here in Vancouver. But you know something, Joe? I don't think anyone's ever proved any of that. I can relay this in a book as something somebody's told me, but I can't prove it.
You know, one of the things I was just thinking about Ridgway was that after he was arrested, he copped a plea, and he's in prison for life. Is that something you could foresee in the Picton case, that your book probably could get published faster than 2 to 3 years to the end of the second trial, if he does in fact come out tomorrow or any day from now and say, yeah, I did it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think I thought some time ago, a few years ago, that could and would happen. But as time goes on, I believe that he will never cop a plea. He will never... what's in it for him? You know, you have to ask yourself, what would be the advantage? In Gary Leon Ridgway's case, there was an advantage. He escaped the death penalty by pleading guilty to those 48 counts of murder. In Mr. Picton's case, we don't have a death penalty in Canada. And what he can probably escape is going to prison too soon. I mean, the longer that this whole procedure goes on, the longer he stays in the North Fraser pretrial, which is a more pleasant environment, I think, than the penitentiaries you might go to. But, you know, he is pleading not guilty. He is considered not guilty until he is found guilty by a jury. And we'll wait and see. I mean, the defense have done a very good job at, raising other issues that will certainly be making this jury think.
One of the things that I was thinking about again, I think of the letters that he's written to people. I guess there's that person in the States, I think, who's pen pals with him at one point. Do you think that that Robert Picton enjoys the sort of celebrity that he's getting out of this? Could that be a possibility of a motive of dragging this out longer, perhaps?
I don't know that.
I guess the question is, in your look at his life with people that have known him, is that perhaps a motivation, a tension?
I can't say. I know that he appears in court on the days that he's there. He looks extremely interested in he pays attention to the testimony, and he writes notes all the time, and he seems to have a pleasant relationship with the sheriffs that bring him in, and he always nods to the judge, bows his head to the judge, and he seems to be kind of caught up in the routine of coming to court and going back to the pretrial again at the end of the day. I've talked to people who've taken him his meals, and they all say he's chirpy and pleasant with them. I think he's adapted pretty well to this existence, and I honestly can't say any more than that about that.
What's the relationship between him and his lawyers? Peter Ritchie, I guess, is the most visible of the defense team. Is there much of a relationship there?
Peter Ritchie has said that he doesn't see much of his client, and I don't think that there is a close relationship at all. I think that during the preliminary hearing, he probably saw a great deal more of Adrian Brooks than he did of Mr. Ritchie. But I don't know. I'm not privy to that. I mean, I'm only going by something Mr. Ritchie himself said, that he wasn't close. He didn't see a lot of his client. It was Marilyn Sanford who actually dealt with Mr. Picton when he was arrested on the murder charges in February 2002. And she's one of his lawyers in this case now.
About the second trial, suppose he's found guilty on these six counts. Could it be possible that the second trial won't go to court? That they may just stay the charges?
That's a good question, because that's what we're all wondering. I mean, we entertain ourselves at great and boring lengths discussing that possibility. We don't know. No one's telling us. But I think the feeling is that there would, given the cost and the time that this has taken, if he is found guilty on these charges, that the Crown might stay the charges on the 20, basically to save, time and money. The families of those 20 women will go crazy because they have been waiting all these years for their daughter's case to go to court. So the authorities will have to factor that in, but they may conclude that it's only makes sense to do that. There's another issue here on that whole scenario, and that is that simply I'm not the only one who's been on this case for 5 years. It's more than 5 years, actually, now. The defense has been on it for 5 years. The prosecutors have been on it for years, and so have the police, and I think would they be forced to carry this on for a second trial? Do they have to stay for a second trial? And all of these people, do they have to be on board? What if the defense says, I've had it, okay, I did this. Then they have to find another defense team. How long is that going to take? What if they had to find a new set of prosecutors? How long would that take? I think these are all issues that they're probably thinking about, but they're certainly not sharing it with the media.
Finally, Stevie, I wanted to ask, you obviously watched this trial. You've watched this trial unfold not only in Vancouver but throughout your travels, at home in Toronto, in Israel. You obviously have seen, heard, and read things that we don't know. Yes. A lot of people that I talk to who follow this case through the newspapers and who only get, what were reported by the media, think that he could get off. Is there any indication as the trial proceeds that that's a possibility?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. He has an extremely able defense team. They're very good. I don't know. The Crown has an excellent case. powerful case. You know, it's going to be the jury. It's going to be those 12 people who will make up their minds. And I think it's a very smart jury, and they're very engaged. They weren't at first. I think they were a little nervous, but I think that they're very comfortable with their responsibility now, and I think they'll make a wise decision. I don't think anyone would give you an answer that's any different from mine. We just don't know.
Does covering this trial, does it become tiresome?
Not for me.
And what do you think it is about for you that makes you want to come back to Vancouver and sit in that courtroom, even though some of the evidence is gruesome and some of the testimony is uncomfortable?
Well, because these women had lives. These were their lives. This is the chance for justice to come to them. And so you avert your eyes because their endings were so horrible? No. And you try to write about it in a way that makes something of their lives and shows that there is justice for everybody in this country. And one of the things that I've found admirable about this case is the fact that Mr. Picton has a very good defense team. You know, provided a public expense, he is being very well defended. And I think that is a mark of a civilized society. He's being ably prosecuted and ably defended.
I said that was the last question, but I have one more, if you'll indulge me. How have you reacted to the reaction to the book from not only critics, but some of the people that you've interviewed and who've participated in the making of this book, if you will?
I've been very touched and really thrilled because people are so positive about it. I mean, I've had a wonderful response from people, and they say that it's a great read. It pulls the whole thing together for them, and that they've really enjoyed this book. I have had one review which complained about all my about the personal stories that I put in it, but that's the Sun review, and that's his opinion. And I guess he didn't like that, and that's fine. But that is what I was commissioned to write. But on the whole, except for that one, the reviews have been terrific, and I actually couldn't be happier with it. It's been a wonderful experience. I was very nervous about it, and very anxious about this, how people would react. But I'm bombarded with calls and emails from people saying that they really like it.
And we will await the second book with great interest. Stevie Cameron, thanks for joining us today.
It was a great pleasure, Joe. I'm glad to be here.